We continue our story where we have Paul in Roman custody, which is wonderful. It's good that he's a prisoner of Rome, because if he were free, he would be dead. That's something you got to keep in mind throughout these prisoner stories. If it were not for the Roman centurions and the Roman military and the Roman politicians trying to prove that this guy either has to have been accused of something worthy of death, or in their mind, they see him as innocent, they're going to keep him guarded because he's a Roman citizen. He has Roman rights. And so he'd be dead if it weren't for these Roman guards. It's strange to see them as the heroes in our story, but they're the heroes in our story at this point, because the Jerusalem mob in the temple had dragged him out. They wanted to kill him. Then the Sanhedrin that Paul met before with the Romans also had nothing good to say about Paul. They wanted to drag him off and kill him. So that everyone of Paul's people, they want him dead. And because he's in Roman custody, they can't follow through with that unless they come up with a great plan. And that's what this story is about. It is the plot to kill Paul. It is the very coordinated and very serious effort to make sure that Paul cannot continue to testify of this Christian faith, particularly because of their disinterest in Paul with his association with the Gentiles. So if you look at verse 12, this is where its story starts. The next morning, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves with an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. More than 40 men were involved in this plot. They went to the chief priest and elders and said, "We've taken a solemn oath not to eat anything until we have killed Paul. Now then, you and the Sanhedrin petition the commander to bring him before you on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about this case. We are ready to kill him before he gets here." So that's the plot. The plot is very simple, and yet it is very large. 40 people is no small amount of assassins that are wanting Paul dead. And it's very coordinated because it's in collusion with the people at the top, the Sanhedrins, the high priest, the Jerusalem Religious Council, the highest body, is in collusion with these assassins, because the assassins say, "Go tell the Romans that you want more accurate information. And then when the Romans are bringing him to us, we'll make sure that one of our assassins leaps from the crowd, pulls out the knife, and stabby, stabby, will take care of this guy." They have to do it that way because the assassins can't in any way try to invade the Roman barracks. That's suicide for sure. They know as long as Paul is kept in the Roman prison, in the Roman barracks, that they're not going to in any way have any access to him. But they know that they can gain access if they bring back Paul, put him on the streets again, and then the assassins can wait in the crowd, and that's how the assassins worked. They waited in the crowd with this guerrilla tactic, and when they saw the person that they wanted to get, someone would race up, boom, stab and run. Hopefully not get caught. So that's the plot. The plot goes all the way to the top. It is not just these assassins. It is the chief priest and at least some of the members of the Sanhedrin, or the Jewish ruling council. So this plot seems really coordinated. It's very large, it's very dangerous, it's very determined, and it's so determined, I hope you noticed, it was mentioned twice, there's a death wish in this. The assassins have made a covenant with death. If you look at verse 12 again, "The next morning the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves with an oath." So they put themselves under a curse that they're not going to eat or drink until they have killed Paul, which is a way of saying either Paul's life ends or our life ends. But somebody's going to die. And whether it's us or Paul, death is going to happen. That is essentially a covenant with death. It is a solemn oath made, and this is the strange part, in the name of preserving God's law, in order to make sure that the traitor that they perceive in Paul is killed. So it is a covenant with death. Someone is going to die no matter what. And in light of that, if we're reading this for the first time, we start feeling a little bit antsy for Paul, because this seems like a large, coordinated, very serious attempt on his life. But what's strange is this wonderful conspiracy is undone by just a few rumors floating about, by a few tongues that flap just a little bit too loosely. Verse 16, But when the son of Paul's sister, that would be Paul's nephew, heard of this plot, he went into the barracks and told Paul. Now, what's strange in the way Luke tells this is he just so happens to hear. He's at the right place at the right time. And you wonder, what's going on here? Obviously, this conspiracy must be widespread. There must be a lot of people talking about it. But maybe there's more than just coincidence going on here, particularly when you go back to verse 11 and remember that the Lord Jesus had visited Paul and said, "Take courage, you will testify for me in Rome." That there may be a connection to that that's deeper than perhaps we might perceive on the surface. But it also could be just a few rumors going about. N.T. Wright has this wonderful imagined conversation of how Paul's nephew might have discovered this plot with a young boy, the nephew saying, "Where's Papa? Where's Abba?" And the mother saying, "Hush, dear, he's doing God's work." "Oh, that's exciting," the boy says. "What does God want him to do?" "Hush, dear, he won't be eating until they've got rid of that troublemaker they caught in the temple." And there you go, it's loose. And then he writes, and a little boy tells another little boy down the street, and they hear of someone else who's in it as well, and soon all the little boys realize there's something going on. And one of them just happens to be the nephew of the man whose name is on everyone's lips, and who will soon, they hope, be at the point of their knives. So the word just spreads as words tend to spread, usually, you know, negative words like this. This collusion is widespread, and it just so happens that this young nephew hears. So he goes to tell Paul, and you notice that in verse 16, he has access to Paul. Back in these days, the prison did not provide food for its prisoners. You had to have relatives or friends or people that would provide you food and other aid. It wasn't provided for you. And so Paul would have this access to friends and families who wanted to help care for him. So his nephew comes, he goes into the barracks, he tells Paul. Paul hears it, and then in verse 17, gives the boy a commission. Then Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the commander. He has something to tell him." So he took him to the commander. And now the nephew's in the presence of the commander that we've been with for the last two chapters. He's the one that's trying to figure out what's going on. He's the one that brought Paul to the Sanhedrin to have them help him understand why everyone wants this guy dead. He's been the one that from the beginning has been trying to make sense of all that's going on. And what's interesting in the next few verses we're going to read is everything we're going to read could have been said with one simple thing. The nephew told the commander, and the commander did this. But instead, Luke is telling a story and he wants to increase the drama. He wants to increase the sense of danger. And so he very slowly lets this story unfold. So he took him to the commander, verse 18. The centurion said, "Paul, the prisoner sent for me and asked me to bring this young man to you because he has something to tell you." The commander took the young man by the hand, drew him aside and asked, "What is it you want to tell me?" He said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul before the Sanhedrin tomorrow on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about him. Don't give in to them, because more than 40 of them are waiting in ambush for him. They've taken an oath not to eat or drink until they have killed him. They are ready now, waiting for your consent to their request." And the commander dismissed the young man and cautioned him, "Don't tell anyone that you've reported this to me." So we get the story told again. Keep in mind, the original hearers of these scriptures would hear the story. They wouldn't read it, they'd hear it. And for the third time, we're told that the assassins have made a covenant with death. So Luke is underscoring this covenant with death. For the second time, we've now heard of how this plan is coordinated at the very top. So we understand that the chief priest and some of the Sanhedrin are involved in this as well. We begin to see the apparent danger to Paul, and the commander knows that the loose lips that sink ships have been opened, and that's why the nephew knows. So he tells the nephew, "Keep your mouth shut. This needs to be hush hush. I'm going to do something about this." And so what he does is what any good Roman centurion would do. In this particular case, he has a Roman citizen who, as far as he can tell, has done nothing wrong, who is sought out by a majority of people that want to kill him. And so he amasses his forces, takes almost half of his military force, and he uses it to get Paul out of Dodge. to make sure Paul is not in this place anymore, because he's obviously not safe here. So verse 23, then he called two of his centurions and ordered them, and you ready for the list? Get ready a detachment of 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at 9 tonight. Provide mounts for Paul so that he may be taken safely to Governor Felix. That's the command, and it's a massive command. I mean, you have almost 500 soldiers that are going to escort Paul to Caesarea. More than half of the people that are under our commander's command. And you think, boy, that seems outrageous, outlandish. Why do you need so many people here assigned to Paul? But the answer is very simple. Tensions are high in Palestine. There's a lot of trouble. That's why Rome is ready at moment's notice to have 600 to 800 soldiers there to quash any kind of rebellion. And they realize they are in the thick of what looks like some big rebellion. They don't understand it, but they need to do something about it. The commander also understands Paul is a strange Jew because he's a full Roman citizen. And being a full Roman citizen, he deserves the rights of any Roman citizen to full protection, particularly in light of the fact that as far as the commander can tell, he's innocent. And being innocent, the commander's reputation is at stake. He is going to make sure that this citizen who has full rights, who as far as he can tell is innocent, is going to be protected and safely transferred to Caesarea so that his rights are not impeded. And then lastly, we have all of this group because there's real danger. 40 assassins. So they go late at night. They take off. They leave for Caesarea. And just so you can see where Caesarea is, here's where Jerusalem is. And they're going to make a stop along the way at this town. But Caesarea is all the way up here on the coast. This is where the governor for Palestine actually would stay. And he'd only come down to Jerusalem in this area during High Holy Feast days. A former governor that lived here is Pontius Pilate. He was the governor of Judea. And before this, 20, 30 years before this, in the time of Jesus, this is where Pontius Pilate resided. He just so happens to be in Jerusalem because it's the time of the Passover. And he needs to be present to make sure that his forces are doing their job. But for the most part, the governor would stay up there. The new governor is Felix. And since Felix is up here, they're going to make sure that this prisoner is taken under Felix's jurisdiction so that he can get the proper trial that he deserves. And so while they're on the way, Claudius, and we for the first time hear the name of our commander. All this time I've been calling him commander or centurion, but his name is Claudius Lysias. And in verse 25 we read him writing a letter. He wrote a letter as follows, Claudius Lysias, to His Excellency Governor Felix, greetings. And now what we're going to get is a civil report. This is the report of a soldier to his higher up. And as we read through this report, it's a pretty accurate report, but I want you to notice a couple of places where he smooths over the story so that he looks good. Because he has not been completely up and up, although he has had integrity throughout this whole thing. Verse 27, this man was seized by the Jews, and they were about to kill him. But I came with my troops and rescued him, for I learned that he is a Roman citizen. Now the astute observer knows that's the most smoothed over line right there. Because he rescued Paul because he needed to keep the peace. He didn't find out he was a Roman citizen until he had him strapped to the flogging pole and he was about to flog him. Get the information out of him through flogging. It's at that point that Paul plays his Roman citizenship card and he learns he's a citizen. So he doesn't learn he's a citizen and then save him. It comes after he's going to put him through this process, which really isn't right. But if you're not a Roman citizen, the Romans are free to do this to you. But Paul was a Roman citizen. So that's the most that he smooths over. I wanted verse 28 to know why they were accusing him, so I brought him to their Sanhedrin. I found that the accusation had to do with questions about their law, and there was no charge against him that deserved death or imprisonment. When I was informed of a plot to be carried out against the man, I sent him to you at once. I also ordered his accusers to present their case against him, and that would be in the presence of Felix. So he says, I saved Paul. doesn't give all the, you know, all the bloody details. Then he says, I put him before the Sanhedrin because I'm trying to figure out and I can't figure this out. And then I've come to this conclusion, and for the first time we hear the commander, Lysias, give his analysis of this whole situation. Verse 29, there's no charge against him that deserved death or imprisonment. That is Lysias saying, he's innocent. I've looked into this matter. I've considered it. I've gone to the higher ups. And my decision is that he doesn't deserve any kind of punishment. He doesn't even deserve to be imprisoned. I just can't find out why everyone wants him dead. So Lysias thinks he's innocent. And that's the first time we've heard that. And he's telling that to Felix. And when you put this all together, you again see how much this echoes Jesus' story. That you have someone in the halls of power saying, you know, he's done nothing to deserve death. He's innocent. I don't see anything wrong with this man, but I'll hand him over to you and maybe you can make something of this. So Lysias says, I didn't see anything wrong, but I have been informed, verse 30, that people want him dead and that's why I'm bringing him to you. And I've told his accusers to come to you in Caesarea and make their case. One of the things that this letter serves to prove for us is that the Roman official is committed to the fact that Paul is innocent. He hasn't broken the law. He hasn't done anything in any way that makes him a threat to the Roman Empire. And it may very well be that Luke is trying to do two things. He's trying to show that Christians within their community, they may not be, you know, people that are easy to understand, but they're not necessarily bad citizens. Paul hasn't done anything against the Roman Empire. He does preach Jesus as Lord, which is to say Caesar is not, but he's going to keep that in his back pocket for now. But for the most part, he's going to testify of that within the system that is in order that he can gain a hearing and not try to overthrow the system as it is. So one of the things Luke might be trying to show is that the Christians are no threat to Rome. In fact, they have a message that should be heard because they're simply trying to convey truth. The other thing that Luke might be trying to show is that the people in power have to admit Paul's innocent. Paul's innocent again and again. And as we go through the remainder of these chapters, Felix, Festus, Agrippa, three people in power, two kings, one governor, they will all say of Paul, I don't find anything wrong with this guy. I don't know why we have him in our custody. And that will send him from one person to the next. I don't find anything wrong. I don't find anything wrong until he's in Rome in prison at the end of Acts. We don't know what he's done wrong, but we know as readers, the gospel's got to Rome. It got there through a prisoner. It got there through a means that Paul wouldn't have wanted or desired, but it has got there in spite of all the trouble and all the sorrow and turmoil. That the gospel has come and planted itself at the uttermost part of the earth. So we're on the way of getting there. Let's conclude this story, though, so we can be ready for the trial before Felix next time we meet. So he writes this letter. He sends it along with the soldiers. So the soldiers, carrying out, verse 31, their orders, took Paul with them during the night and brought him as far as Antipatris. That was the first city I showed you on our map. The next day, they let the cavalry go on with him while they returned to the barracks. You know why they need to return to the barracks? Almost half of the force has gone outside of Jerusalem. They need to be back there. That's where they do their job. So they go as far as halfway there, and then they go back now that they're in a safer zone and perhaps the assassins aren't going to be following. Verse 33, when the cavalry arrived in Caesarea, they delivered the letter to the governor and handed Paul over to him. The governor, and this would be Felix, read the letter and asked what province he was from. Learning that he was from Cilicia, because Paul's of Tarsus, he said, I will hear your case when your accusers get here. Then he ordered that Paul be kept under guard in Herod's palace. So Felix is the follower of Pontius Pilate. He's the one now in power. He says, okay, I've read this report. I'm going to wait for accusers. Go hang in prison until they come. And that's where we're left. Paul is again in prison. He is not a free man, and yet his life's been saved. The plot is not successful. And it's not successful not simply because of the Roman military that have taken quick and speedy action, but it is not successful because of this strange coincidence of Paul's nephew having heard a rumor and passing it on. The one thing that is frustrating for us as readers is Paul's still in prison. He hasn't done anything wrong. No one thinks he's done anything wrong, again, except for those who want him dead. But that's going to be the way the rest of the story plays out. No one's ever going to be able to pin anything on him, but yet he remains in prison. Well, that's our story. Next week we'll look at the trial before Felix. You notice that's a long chapter, and it'll be the whole chapter we look at. And actually, it's 2 weeks from now, because next Wednesday is July 4th. We won't be having service, but then the following week we'll pick up on chapter 24. As always, I want to provide a couple of reflections. I have three of them, and it has to do with what I thought of when I thought of this story, that when you think of this story and its placement in the book of Acts for us, it shows us three situations that are somewhat strange. It shows us a situation where religion has become utterly toxic because it is a religion that has made a covenant with death. These are religious fanatics, these assassins, and they've made a covenant with death. And what's tragic about that is that they are children of God's covenant to Abraham who've made a covenant with death. It's the people that have made covenant with God, a God who says, choose life, a God who speaks of life, and yet they've made a covenant with death so that their religion has boiled down to this, his life or ours. But somebody's going to die. And we're so seriously committed to this, if he doesn't die, then we'll die. And you could think, well, this is just some fringe fanatics, 40 assassins who are on the fringe. Well, no. Because this goes all the way to the top in the Sanhedrin. This goes to the chief priest. This is at the heart of Israel's faith at the moment. This corruption at the very core. And what that corruption is it has completely perverted what the faith of Israel has always been about. It's a religion of life. It's a religion that says, my life for yours. Instead of a covenant with death, which says, my life or yours. Those are two different covenants. And at the end of the day, particularly in light of Christ, who says, love your enemies, who calls us to sacrificial service, our slogan should always be, my life for yours. You matter. Your life matters. You have dignity. You have worth. You are someone that's loved by God and you are worth preserving. My life for yours. I give myself for you. That's to follow in the way of the Master who followed in the way of the law, which was choose life. To be a blessing to the nations and a blessing to the others. But these fanatics have turned my life for yours into my life or yours. But one of us is going to die. Because the idol of death, which is pursued through the passion of violence, is at the heart right now of religion in this story. It is religion that's absolutely toxic. And what makes it the most toxic, friends, is it is this covenant with death that perceives itself to be in the right because they're defending the law. In defense of God's law, which says, thou shalt not murder, they're going to murder. Because the traitor must die. That's when you know religion has become the most corrupt. When it's willing to abandon what is central to its tenets and to make an exception and say, well, but in this case that doesn't apply. The holy thing to do is to kill this traitor. So you have this incredible toxic religion, and what's going to happen in less than 10 years? The temple will be destroyed by Rome. Jerusalem will be devastated. Because this kind of fanaticism won't go unjudged. And Jesus warned, oh Jerusalem, oh Jerusalem, how I long for you. I'd love to pull you under my wings. But if you're not going to turn from these ways, then things are going to go to hell. It's all going to fall. And that's what's happening. It's going to happen by the time this story is over, that this kind of fanaticism, which we now see is at the heart of temple, at the heart of this generation, not always, this is not anything against Judaism, but this particular generation is so corrupt, so perverse at its very core, at its very heart, that it will be judged. So this is what happens when religion becomes toxic. The good news, which is a strange good news, is this is what happens when the world behaves better than God's people. Because it's no doubt if this is the only story we had in the book of Acts, you'd have to say, well, better to be a Roman soldier than to be, you know, on the side of those defending God's law. Because they at least have integrity. They're trying to preserve life. They are more committed to their Roman constitution than these are committed to their Jewish law. Robert Wall has a wonderful quote where he kind of says that same thing. I just ripped him off, sorry. Paul has more status in secular society as a Roman citizen than in Israel as an observant Jew. This is not to claim that Rome's perspective on Paul and his mission is favorable. They really just don't know what to do with him. So it's not like they're fans of Paul's. They just don't know what to do. Rather, it is simply to assert that the Rome of Acts is more obedient to its constitutional law than unrepentant Israel of Acts is to its biblical law. And it is the case when religion is empty, then rights have to prevail. That's all you have left is rights. It's sad when that's all we have to rely upon, just constitutional rights, because there should be a higher sense that God's moral law, God's divine will, you know, takes precedence over even that. But when people fail to follow that, at least there's some rights to fall back on, and that's what's happening with Paul, because at this point, the world's behaving better than God's people. Which leads to my third and last reflection, which has to do when coincidence aligns with good, and that seems to be what's happening here. Our plot against Paul was foiled by a young man. This might have been a young boy. He probably is anywhere from 12 to 20, probably not much older than that, based on the word that's used to speak about him. And he's the one that foils the plot because he just happens to overhear others talking about it. And the word we use for just happening to hear is the word coincidence. And if we don't use coincidence, we use the word luck. And of course, it could be both of those things. But there's a strange connection that I'd like to make. If you go back to the beginning of our reading, he just so happens to hear this, but before this whole story begins in verse 11, Paul had been encouraged in the midst of his sorrow and frustration of being imprisoned and nobody understanding and being troubled by whether he'd ever be out of this jail and whether he'd ever be able to testify of his faith and ever get to Rome, which was his great passion. The Lord appears to him and says, "Take courage. Just as you've testified about me in Rome, you must also testify in Jerusalem. You must also testify in Rome." I find it interesting that the same night that this young boy just happens to hear, to overhear of this plot, that same night Paul is receiving a vision from the Lord Jesus Christ saying, "You're going to make it to Rome. Take heart." And it makes you think perhaps this is exposing what Dallas Willard calls a deeper conspiracy. He calls it the divine conspiracy. That at the end of the day, all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to God's purpose. The sense that God can take anything good and bad and shape and structure it in such a way that there is a divine conspiracy that is wishing our good and willing our good and bringing about our good, which ultimately is to be formed in the likeness of Christ. It's not necessarily to be healthy, wealthy, and successful and charming and all of that. It's to be formed in the image of Christ. But in this case, it's to protect Paul so that he can witness. And it may be that there's a bigger conspiracy going on than these assassins and a few high priests. That there is a divine conspiracy that is so deep and so pervasive, where God is planning the good of God's people and bringing about the welfare of the witness of the gospel, that it just so happens that the nephew hears. It just so happens that the lips spill the secret. I kind of like looking at it that way, just because I know everything doesn't always seem to work out for good, and there are tragic things that happen, and I'm not naive. I'm not trying to paint a rosier picture than need be, but I can tell you many times where things have just so happened for me, and they've just so happened in such a way that what I thought was going to be bad is completely transformed to be something that actually it's better that this happened to me, even though I would never have chosen it, because it got me here. Again, not trying to be naive, not trying to be too rosy, but trying to present the picture that maybe coincidence is overrated. Maybe if you see a lot of coincidence happening all at once, we need to move away from the idea of luck and coincidence to the divine conspiracy that God is bringing all things together for good. Well, that is my three thoughts on this. It leaves us with the death wish. And I, you know, if you had a little epilogue to this whole story, because I called it death wish, wasn't that who's the big Bronson. Yeah, and I've never seen the story. I don't know what it's about. I don't know if it's about assassins or anything. I just like the title, Death Wish, because that's what these assassins' covenant with death is. I wonder, and I would like you to wonder with me, I wonder if the assassins are getting hungry at this point. I wonder if they're starting to think, you know, a cup of water would be nice right now. I wonder if they're regretting their decision, if they're sticking to their guns, that, you know, we're in the right. Even though our plot was foiled, we're in the right and we're not going to move from this position. But my guess is all of them along the way somewhere had to abandon their covenant of death, because I would bet money none of them followed through with their end of the bargain. That somewhere they start to renounce that covenant, or at least act as if they ever made it.